Oh, it's wonderful to hear all these, so many voices this morning. And welcome to all of you, some of whom I don't see so often, and I'll nag you a little bit to come back and sit when you can at the Zendo. Because all of us here, and especially my partner Barbara Joshin Sensei, and we're all on a path of Bodhi, all on a path of awakening, of entering fully into our lives and serving as we can. This is our way. This is our path. You know, in the Platform Sutra that we're studying now, we're encouraged to engage a straightforward mind. The samadhi of oneness is straightforward mind at all times, walking, sitting, and lying down. I would say in relationship. We have a koan in our tradition that says, how do you go straight on a path with 99 curves? Ignoring the double meaning of straight, of course. What does the sutra and what does the koan suggest to us? No matter what, we meet each barrier in our life, each thing that we encounter, with a heart and mind that is willing to go into it, to go forward, to connect with what is in front of us. And for me, that's all of the path of awakening. My long relationship with Joshin Sensei has been a path with many curves. A path of awakening. And I have tried to just keep going and to keep learning from every aspect of the relationship. I love the word attunement. Joshin Sensei taught me that word. And although I might lack the psychotherapeutic theoretical nuance to attunement, I understand it as being tuned in, as responding with my heart and my body and my mind to what is unfolding. A quality of being attuned to myself and to the other and to everything that's going on around us. A willingness to engage every aspect in all the joys and irritations, the struggles and delights of human life. And for me, the best attunement, the best practice of attunement, or the best practice of the way is to work with the one who is nearest to me, the one with whom I have a deep and loving 26-year relationship. That's the work of relationship. You know, I've always said relationship is the hardest thing. It's the deepest work. To be willing to enter in the dragon's cave over and over again. Because the dragon is actually Bodhi. The dragon is enlightenment. And why is Bodhi a dragon? Because she looks fierce. The fierceness that is liberation. And for me, this reflects the Buddhist notion of the three marks of existence. They sound scary, the three marks. People avoid them all the time. But seen with clear eyes, they are guiding lights to our own awakening, to attuning to life and attuning to intimate relationship. The three marks. All existence is separate, isolated. There is no autonomous self. All existence is impermanent, everything subject to change. All existence is colored by some quality of unsatisfactoriness, some quality of suffering. So the first one, the infamously misunderstood no self, is actually simply a spacious and open-hearted way to recognize the multiple aspects of self and other. When I recognize that Joshin Sensei and I are actually, and all of us in this room, we have no fixed self. Rather, all of us are constantly shifting set. Memories and impressions, feelings, thoughts, all flowing together. Some emerging at one point, and others dropping away for a while, and then arising again. And when I recognize that, then I am free. I'm not stuck in some sense of myself or sense of the other. I'm free to attune to right now. Are you ready to go? Well, I'm ready to go. What's happening right now? And in a one-to-one relationship, it becomes even more clear. What I am calling me and what I am calling you. My mother, your father, your sisters and my cousins, all our ancestors, cultural forms, our childhood experiences, our preferences. It's as if all these histories and people were all on a big barge going down the Hudson, constantly changing clothes. That's us. That's who we are. We're so wild and strange, all of us. And we want to coalesce into one self that is, this is me. But you know, no. No separate self. And to try to control self or other is craziness. We're constantly constructing the other, and the other is constantly constructing us. Co-creating the selves constantly. A continuous practice. There is vast emptiness. And also, a person right here. That's the Buddha way. It's not just the Buddha way. The great Indian Vedanta master, Nisargadatta, said, "When I see that I am nothing, that is wisdom. When I see that I am everything, that is love. My life is a movement between these two." Could rephrase it. When I see that you are nothing, that is wisdom. When I see that you are everything, that is love. Our life is a movement between these two. And seeing ourselves in this way gives us the freedom to recognize change, to recognize the constantly changing aspect of ourselves. That's the second great characteristic of Buddhism, the mark. All existence is impermanent. All is subject to change. And we know it, and it's obvious, and how we resist it. We resist the notion that we are constantly changing, and that everything and everyone around us is. But when we can accept this, we stopped reacting habitually. We become more open to what is next. Oh, who are you now? Who am I now? We discover ourselves becoming. And life becomes much more an adventure. A risky relationship. An exciting relationship. How many times with Joshin Sensei have I thought, oh, wow, I'm being changed by this. And in our lives, in the world that we live in, we've seen our relationship viewed differently. Originally, discreetly understood. Then officially, as domestic partners in New York City. Then, New York liberal legal last month at City Hall. That's why we went to City Hall. We wanted to see an official recognition. And then to have gay marriage mentioned in the inaugural speech this week was really powerful for a lot of us. We couldn't believe it. You know, we've always been able to make compromises and understand why it's not mentioned. It was very powerful. This is impermanence. Our world is changing. Some of you have asked why, after so many years, we decided to get married. And I would say it's looking at the inevitable. So she can claim the body. Which leads me to the last of the three existences. The reality of suffering. The reality of unsatisfactoriness in every relationship, in every existence. No matter how much we love someone, and as a matter of fact, it has a lot to do with how much we love someone. Another point in the day, maybe, not so much. But when we're feeling a sense of love, and the other one, not so much, we can experience what this, one of my favorite Japanese poems. It's written by an 8th century Japanese woman. To love somebody who doesn't love you is like going to a temple and worshiping the behind of a wooden statue of a hungry devil. The love brings with it a lot of snarky feelings, a lot of sadness. I love this poem because it's hard not to be the center of love and attention and praise. But actually, why should we be all the time? I mean, really. The truth of no separate self, the truth of impermanence, shows us that everything is shifting and our suffering shifts. Our sense of what is unsatisfactory does not depend on the other, although we want to pin it on them, but it is the nature of existence. Oh, having a feeling of unsatisfactoriness. Don't blame it. It is a quality of existence. It's my responsibility. It's my mind that is creating this suffering and this sense of unsatisfactoriness. And I believe, I have been taught by Dzogchen Sensei that it is our ability to attune, to get in the rhythm and coherence of the one who is with us, that brings all of this together. The Buddha way is in our relations with others. It is in our relations with others that we find our path. We just need to listen. To listen. I want you to listen to what Dzogchen has to say now. But let me close with this one verse by Sid Corman. I will tell you the secret. Listen. What is it, you ask? I keep telling you. Listen.
That's beautiful. Well, the fact that it's taken us 26 years to publicly avow our commitment reminds me of the joke of a couple in their 80s who go to a lawyer for a divorce. And the lawyer says, well, why did you wait so long? And the couple says, well, we had to wait until the children were dead. And I want to say that in our case, it was our children, our Sangha, grown mature, who helped us to make it possible. That is, to publicly affirm our connection of 26 years and to honor the survival of something that, you know, because we happen to have a similar last name. You know, in a sense, we kind of just took it for granted that we were family, that we were always married. But there is something different about actually saying, wait a minute. What is it that we have been doing? What is it, who are we for each other? And how does this thing hang together? Because, you know, if we go back in our Zen history, you know, and I'm thinking at least as far as our Dharma grandfather, Maizumi Roshi, the phrase Zen widow or widower was a common description of partners, of Zen practitioners who wanted to pursue the way wholeheartedly, which meant, you know, that the spouse of a Zen teacher would have to live with the reality of his or her unavailability for long periods of time, for a lot of the time, you know, the teacher would either be in the Dokusan room or away on retreat or even on pilgrimage. And then on the rare occasion when he or she would be home, their time would be taken up maybe preparing a Dharma talk. And so with all of their time going into studying the Dharma, teaching the Dharma, spreading the Dharma, the spouse or the child or children couldn't compete for attention. And so the reality that in our tradition here, at least, I don't know about Japan, but here at least, there have been Zen orphans, Zen widows and widowers. Family relationships got second shrift to the primary task of spreading the Dharma. Now, in our case, Roshi Enkyo was the first to experience this abandonment because at the beginning of our relationship, following my mother's death, I went to a monastery for a year. It was a searing separation that I'll never forget. We both cried. Roshi drove me up. And we knew it was momentous. And yet, something that couldn't be helped, had to be done. That year turned into 3. And, you know, I think of military personnel, you know, who are shipped overseas, and the spouse left behind, you know, anything can happen. A grenade can explode. They can fall in love with somebody else. And during that time, I knew that deep down we had this undissolvable union. But it would take for time to reveal that, to unfold that. When I came back, a sitting group had been formed in Enkyo Roshi's apartment. And so then I adjusted myself. It wasn't much of an adjustment, really. The schedule wasn't that much different. We mopped the floors. We arranged flowers on the altar, cooked for the Zazen Kai, and made sure to leave no traces anywhere so that when the sitters arrived, there would be no distractions. My room was the Dokusan room, which meant no personal possessions. And so for those years, we lived at 15 Washington Place like monks in a cell. Until we decided it might be healthier for the Sangha and for the village Zendo, not to mention our own relationship, for the Zendo, the village Zendo, to have its own space. So we can talk about the fact that conditioning is empty. You know, that it's constantly changing. It really has no fundamental reality. And yet, I think that Western psychological development has taught us that early imprints leave traces that can only be, if you like, mopped up through exquisite awareness of exactly what those traces are, what the template is. And unless we know what, have a sense of what the contours of those early imprints are, we are not going to be able to make those choices when we're faced with the triggers. You see? So it's taken me a while to learn that as the middle child, let's say, of a large family, it behooved me to not want what I couldn't have, but just to say to dismiss needs, personal needs of a direct nature for attention, for time, for sometimes being the most important person in a set of circumstances. And what I would say about my relationship with Enkyo is that it has been a chance to heal that conditioning that required of me not to have any needs. And it took me a while to realize that prematurely becoming a Buddha before having the chance to completely allow my own humanness was ultimately not the best solution, taking shortcuts to, if you like, sainthood or martyrdom wasn't the best ingredient or recipe for a healthy relationship. And I want to say that it was the Sangha, you, who taught me that through precisely with Roshi's comings and goings, your practice, whether she was here or not, you're showing up, you're making it your own, meant that it didn't depend on Roshi being here, that you could flower and could blossom your own practice and make it yours. And that, I think, was what made the space for us to turn our attention to each other. As Roshi said, you know, spending time with a loving audience or an attentive sangha can be more gratifying than attending to the murky, unsettling depths of an intimate relationship with its uncanny capacity to reawaken the pain of those hidden hurt places that we think we've outgrown, or that we want to feel we've outgrown, just by waving the magic wand of emptiness. As we both age, we've become aware of how little time we have left to do this work, to learn how to give and receive from one another the kind of attunement that neither of us got in those early years. And it's still, I'm here to attest, a work in progress. And ultimately preparations, Roshi said, for the final abandonment, which is death. And for me, the hope is to say that we didn't run from the chance to heal those hurts in the guise of taking care of others.
Or
spreading the Dharma. I'd like to say that we took care of one another so that we could be there for others. And for me, that's the Dharma.